The Meaning of Geranium from The Secret Language of Plants by Andrina, read by Sam Gabriel, based on the works of J.K. Rowling. Chapter 3. Not Calling It War Yet. The prophecy said, next week there will be dust and blood and the smell of leather. On Monday evening, 7 Death Eaters broke into the Ministry and the Department of Mysteries. They were stopped at the doors of the Hall of Prophecies by a small number of wizards, all order-related. Someone, Moody, brought down the doors and part of the ceiling to close the access to the prophecies. Maybe this was the dust. It certainly made things dirty. It only occurred to them then that a prophecy could only be retrieved by those concerned by it. Since Harry Potter had made himself quite inconveniently scarce, he could not be deceived nor manipulated into doing that favor. The Dark Lord had to come himself. There was just a short moment while they fought the Death Eaters to let the fear brought by that realization sink its teeth into the tender flesh of their necks. Just a moment, and then Voldemort himself was there, and Nymphadora Tonks was on the floor, dying. She survived. For some unfathomable reason, he had not cast Avada Kedavra. For the first 3 days, however, she wished she had died. She spent a whole week bleeding out of every orifice of her body. The healers worried that in the event that she lived, she might not be able to conceive any children, and Tonks was coughing up too much blood to explain to them that really, that was not a concern of hers at the moment. But that would be on Friday, when Emmeline Vance would hit the Metawizard with her bag and tell them to just cure her already. Forget about conception. For now, she lay on the floor, watching her blood spread over the black marble. Oh, how Bellatrix laughed. Perhaps the curse had been cast for her, so she could see her mudblood cousin purified. She didn't laugh for long. Kingsley Shacklebolt kept her busy. They were outnumbered, but Moody had made enough noise that other wizards were coming. Maximinus Minchell was turned into a bearded lizard as soon as he set foot in the hall. Galantina Cortazar managed to successfully stupefy Rodolphus Lestrange, and she was so surprised by it that she could not stop the curse that hit her soon after. Voldemort advanced through the fighting wizards, the hem of his robe wet with blood. The fallen mortar and stone of the hall started to shake as he got closer to the Hall of Prophecies and its blocked entrance. No, he would not get there. He would not take the prophecy. His scream, when he realized it, was enough to turn the hair of the closest wizards white. A woman fainted, with a small trickle of blood coming from her ears. Dumbledore had come. So had many other people, including Fudge, who could no longer deny the undeniable, but in that moment nobody cared about Fudge, or Umbridge, or Dawlish. Although Dawlish was a special operator, so if he could see his way to joining the fight, that would be welcomed. People only cared about Dumbledore's arrival. He was the only one the Dark Lord ever feared, the one who could chase the monster out. The duel was nasty, and took longer than anyone expected. They evacuated the room. Order and Ministry and Death Eaters all mixed together while they fled. The blood on the floor was rising, turned into a river that would drown them all. It was well above waist height when the last witch exited. They couldn't see Dumbledore. Then the blood rose higher, making a giant wave that took the form of an eagle that fell over Voldemort. But as the claws were about to tear him apart, the eagle dissolved into 1,000 beetles that scattered around the room. Voldemort cast 3 curses in quick succession, and then when Dumbledore was half-turned, Avada Kedavra. Dumbledore avoided all of them, and even managed to send one of the curses, a nasty thing of a purple so dark it was almost black, back to him. As they fought, they moved, little by little, away from the prophecies and back to the atrium, fighting for every step. Dumbledore made a rope of golden light that turned into a net, and then into a cage surrounding Voldemort. One touch with Voldemort's wand, that feared bone-white wand, and the bars broke as if they were simply made of caramel, hundreds of crystal shards raining on the corridor. Voldemort sent a wind strong and sharp that would shave away the flesh off your bones. There was more running. A few Death Eaters abandoned the place, and the rest were quickly arrested. The wind parted around Dumbledore. All he had lost was a thread from his sleeve and a few errant hairs from his beard. As soon as the wind abated, a fire emerged from Dumbledore's wand. The fire took the shape of a lion, a winged lion that ran towards Voldemort. It was a ruse, however, just a distraction so we could attack the very ground where Voldemort was standing, the hard stone transforming and rising as if to engulf him. But Voldemort noticed. He chose, and he chose well. The fire lion got him 3 slashes of his claws before disappearing, but he stopped the creeping hand of stone that would have crushed him. Voldemort had never been one for subtlety. He turned the moving stone into a single giant boulder and threw it at Dumbledore at full speed. Dumbledore made a whip-like movement and slashed the stone, cutting it as if it were soft as butter. It fell to the floor in little pieces, the edges hot and glowing white. And then he jumped and turned to avoid a thin green line Voldemort had sent. Dumbledore cast 3 white balls that soon became red and did nothing but took the green line with them. Voldemort made a black smoke that whispered terrors. Dumbledore just managed to dispel it when it was almost swallowing him whole. There was a sandstorm, and nobody knew who had created it or who changed it into fire. There was a giant snake biting and spitting venom, and 3 kestrels fighting it. At some point, the whole atrium was full of white, just white, and it was suffocating. There were scorpions with glossy shells crawling down the walls. For some reason, the women, and only the women, would remember them clearly, more than anything else. There was a silence, the feeling of an ancient, hungry presence. It was dispelled by the ring of a silver bell. There was a curse in an old tongue, words that brought madness and tears and made people fall to their knees, except for the truly innocent, and for those born in the night between April and May. Nobody spoke of the moment when everything was covered with sore boils. And then, Voldemort left. There was a horrified silence at the wreckage of the Ministry. Perhaps the dust meant this. Dumbledore left soon after. People wouldn't know, couldn't know, that there had been no victory today. Only the 2 men, Voldemort and Dumbledore, only the 2 of them and their closest lieutenants on which they chose to confide, would know that neither had come away unscathed, that they had both lost that day. Fudge's removal was immediate and flashing. Perhaps the dust meant this, his downfall was so quick people could only see the fluttering dust left behind. Rufus Scrimgeour was next. Head of the Auror office, he had organized the evacuation and stood behind to protect the Ministry wizards when the devouring wind came. He was a man like an old lion, the old hard lion that has returned from many hunts, where he was both prey and hunter. He wore a leather coat and smelled like oil and everything masculine. He had dueled and killed Augustus Rookwood, saved many lives when he took that one. There was no doubt the prophecy meant him. It was, indeed, a confusing week. Harry and Draco spent most of their time in the library because that's where Creature brought the post. They tried hanging around the entrance, but there was a cold draft, ugly decor, and the portrait of Walburga Black. Besides, Creature was adamant on following the traditions of the house, and as soon as he got the paper, he apparated to the library because he could not tolerate the idea of handing it off in the entrance hall. Together they read of Sirius and Remus's escape. Together they read of the battle in the Department of Mysteries and the terrified acceptance that, yes, you know who had returned. They read of Fudge's resigning before his official removal, and of Scrimgeour taking his place. They did little else for the first few days. This house felt more haunted than the other one. She had accepted them, but they were not welcome, and she refused to change to accommodate them. Still, they carved out a life from the hostile, hard, tight body of the house. The library became theirs. It was the place where they got the news, where they learned that the closest they had ever had to proper parents had escaped, had survived. That room was theirs. They had been busy crying and laughing in each other's arms at the time, and so they missed the very rare vision of a Bockert in its natural state, crawling from under the armchair and hurriedly leaving the room to go hide in the master bedroom. They spent the first night there, laying together on the rug and sharing the cushions and blankets from the armchairs. Both of them pressed together like they had been during the mad ritual in the kitchen, pressed together in the same way of the sculptures or skeletons unearthed by archaeologists. A pose they could hold for centuries while the outside world went down its mad way and their bones turned to stone. And there was something about comfort and protection there, in the small circle they were making with their bodies. It would take them days to find and clear the bedrooms on the 3rd floor, the ones that belonged to Sirius and Regulus. Harry took the ladder, He intuitively understood that Draco would prefer Sirius's, even with all the Gryffindor decor. And Harry didn't really mind the other bedroom. Regulus seemed to have been a very introspective and intellectual young man. His room was full of interesting books about foreign magic. Despite having two bedrooms, they still slept together many times, just as they had that first night. Maybe through the night, or maybe an exhausted nap during the day. Nothing more than that, just sleep. Heads close and arms around each other. Just the comfort of another warm body, another breath, another heartbeat besides your own in the big empty house. Harry had nightmares, but less so when he could press his face to Draco's chest. Draco's pulse was quick and lively, and not at all like the relaxing, repetitive beat that supposedly will make you slow down and fall asleep. But it wasn't about falling asleep. Harry could fall asleep. It was about having a proof of life near, and not waking sweating with terror from a nightmare about illness and death, so much death, extending like a plague and covering everything until there was only Harry, all alone, in a deserted and blackened world. Harry found himself seeking refuge in Draco's bed after waking from those nightmares. Draco, on the other hand, never had nightmares, but then again he couldn't fall asleep to begin with. When he found himself so exhausted that he could cry and still wasn't able to sleep, he went to Harry, because something in the rhythm of his breath and the warmth of his body, and maybe even the smell of his skin and his hair, could make Draco fall asleep right away. Something about Harry's presence allowed him to slow down and relax. They had never had this trouble sleeping in the haunted house, even when the poltergeist spooked them. But there was no point thinking about that. It was not about what had happened then. It was about now and the problems they faced. And this was one of the easy ones to solve. While the rest of the wizarding world was frozen in a terrified stupor, these were long days full of hard work for Harry and Draco. No one, not even them, had realized the potential that hid in the space between them. No one had truly seen how well they fitted together. There was that core of resolution and strength inside Harry, that heart of diamond that helped him survive unbent and unbroken. While Draco was taken by the fire of his namesake. Draco was coming to that stage where he could not be hurt, only killed, because otherwise he would bounce back from everything with redoubled energy and rage. What a marvelous thing that they had both known kindness, that the last few months they had someone to show them love. It would be a terrible thing if they were to grow cold hearts, a terrible thing indeed, for them, but mostly for the world. The house didn't want them and didn't want to change. But it had nothing to do against them. Resistance was futile. They worked diligently, fueled by creature's food and the diamond and the fire. They removed the dust and the spiders and the doxies. They opened the back door, that little, unassuming door with cracking white paint, and held it open with a bucket full of water for a whole hour to air the house. Harry went room by room during that hour, saying that the door was open and the creatures were invited to leave. Most didn't, but the boggart that used to live in the library did, followed by the ghoul under the stairs. He had seen them, gotten the taste of them. Better move if he wanted to survive. They removed the remaining doxies. Another attempted to eat Draco, and Harry hit it with an iron pan. If you can't or won't cast Spirantalis, iron is fine. He hit him so hard that the ring was heard through the whole house, and the nether was reduced to a gooey stain on the carpet that they later had to scrape off. It was subtle, but creature became a bit more accommodating after that. They were cautious and did not do any magic. Wizarding house or not, it was possible that the trace would be activated. Harry was confident that he would manage to fool any wizard from the ministry now that he was not consumed by grief, but probably no more than once. Someone ought to find it funny if they kept getting traces of underage magic from the same address. While Harry cleaned as much as he could, Draco was tasked with identifying every cursed or dangerous object in the house, mostly because he had seen plenty of similar ones in Malfoy Manor. Creature provided a pair of dragon-hide gloves, and Draco would very carefully take each object and place it in a trunk to be stored in the attic. Since he was so careful about wrapping them, and even wrote a list with a description, Creature didn't try to steal them back. It felt wrong making Creature help with this. It was enough that he cooked for them. The poor elf wasn't completely there, and they weren't about to put more strain on him. The prohibition of speaking a word about them was doing enough on his fragile mental state. Especially because some of the portraits kept asking what was going on. It is dark, and we can hear movements. So they saved the magic, be it human or elfish, for emergencies, and did everything by hand. The cleaning and dusting and removal of doxies, they were everywhere. You never finished taking the doxies out. The carving of a home. Years later, Draco would have a flashback to this time, to himself in an old t-shirt, slightly sweaty and disheveled, dragging down the stairs the corpse of a necromantula the size of a dog. Years later, Draco would have to sit down and have a small freak out at the nonchalance with which he had hunted and killed and disposed of the monster, shoving it in the dumpster at the end of the street because their own garbage was full. It was not agoraphobia, all right? It was not. It was just a sudden fear of leaving the house. The trips to the dumpster were fine, if done quickly, early in the morning or evening, but it was impossible to take one single step beyond that. The house was safe. It was horrible, but it was safe. Beyond that was Voldemort, a Voldemort who now dared to show his face in public, and the Ministry of Magic, which, new minister or not at the head, was still a horrible institution, and Dumbledore and the people of Hogwarts, who were not bad, but could be terribly hurtful nevertheless, even if that wasn't their intention. And above all of them was London itself. As it often happens with big cities, old cities, they have a life and a character of their own. Not necessarily evil, but hard and overwhelming. Walking through these kinds of cities, when you are not ready, is like navigating a dark sea without compass or stars. And there was a letter sitting in the escritoire in the library. It was a very good letter, written carefully after many attempts, and with both of them going over it to make sure they didn't let slip anything compromising. It was an excellent letter, to send to Severus or to Sirius and Remus and let them know that they were all right, in a safe place, and they could come pick them up whenever. It was a good letter, well-coded. They were pretty sure that if someone intercepted it, they wouldn't be able to figure out its meaning. But still, they didn't dare send it. Not to Severus, certainly. When the mere fact that he was receiving a letter from Harry would be compromising enough. Sirius and Remus, then. Only it meant stepping out of the house. And the familiar street. And going into London and its maze of streets and people and finding a wizarding pub and going in there with a disguise and asking for an owl and then waiting for a response. Harry had read the Odyssey when he was a child, and later he had asked Severus to get him a proper copy, not one of those versions adapted for children, but a translation of the original poem. It is not an easy text to read. The flow of the names and the invocations and the ideas feel clunky when it is not in the original Greek. But despite this difficulty, Harry had liked it better. You see, in the version they give to children, Odysseus jumps from adventure to adventure before finally arriving at Ithaca and Penelope. It is an adventure book, and not a very good one, given how many sailors keep drowning and getting eaten. It is, in fact, a horrible adventure book for children, and Harry had been a bit concerned that Odysseus didn't show more regard for the sailors. The poem, though, the poem opens with Ithaca and the family waiting, and then goes to a tired Odysseus who has been trying to get back for a decade. It is not an adventure story. It is the story of someone who is close to broken, languishing on an island accompanied by someone they abhor, but too tired to start the trip again. Too tired to face the monsters and navigate the sea with only the stars as a guide. They hated the house. A house they could swear was made from the black exoskeleton of a scarab and a scorpion, but right now, even if Harry had been shaken from his stupor and they had trampled their grief to the ground, they were both too tired. Too tired to sail around London and steer away from Voldemort and the Ministry and the siren song of the Order. They didn't send the letter. They repeated to themselves that Remus had made them promise that they would take care of each other and stay safe and not take any risks. Going out and sending the letter was a big risk. Perhaps they would still have attempted it had it been just a risk to themselves. But it could also mean a risk to Sirius and Remus if they accidentally revealed where they were hiding, and they could not risk their recently gained freedom. They didn't like it, but they were both very well used to accepting things they didn't like. If there was any frustration over it, they could turn it against the house that was both a hated place and a fortress against the outside world. Molly Weasley did not approve of her twin son's business adventure, but there was little she could do about it. What she could do, however, was to request her son's presence every Sunday to have lunch at the borough with the rest of the family, and the order members that were still using the place as base of operations, of course. The world wasn't going to end if you didn't sit down to Molly's table. Now, Shacklebolt, sit down now. Did you wash your hands? Yes, Booty, I know there was a battle, but that was on Monday, so sit down and eat a meal like normal people do. Thanks to these meals, the twins were able to report back that not only the Ministry had no idea that Harry Potter had been 5 minutes away from them, but neither did the Order. Although, of course, the Order always suspected that Lupin and Black couldn't be very far away from Harry, and they had investigated the area thoroughly. "What did they find?" asked Sirius anxiously. Remus took things with more restraint. He had been right twice already with Harry. "That someone in the Order has a tattoo on their bum," said George, grinning. "Sadly, Tonks refused to tell us who. We think Moody. Apparently there's a spirit living there that doesn't take well to visitors." So they knew nothing, other than a general suspicion that Harry had not died in the broom accident. Severus, on the rare occasions he came to the Burrow to report, could confirm the same for his part. Voldemort, Dumbledore, and the Ministry all thought Harry had gone into hiding, but there was no agreement over who was hiding him. Since the two most obvious suspects had been captured and then released sans Harry, people were at a loss about where to look next. And there was also the other matter. They had all been pretty isolated in the haunted house. They got news from Severus and what little they overheard at the pub, so they knew it was happening in general terms. But they weren't in a position to notice the conspicuous absence of news relating to Draco Malfoy. There were reports of sightings of Harry Potter every week, because most people thought or hoped that Harry Potter was alive. However, there was no news whatsoever about Draco Malfoy, because everybody believed that he had been killed. It was, in fact, the only point of contention for the twins, who had been really accommodating about keeping everything else secret. This was the only thing they wished they could broadcast to everyone. The rumor mill at Hogwarts already said they shouldn't worry about Harry, so it was okay to keep quiet. Apparently the Muggleborns saw something the rest didn't in the paper, something that the Order, Voldemort, and the Ministry couldn't see. And keeping Remus and Sirius' presence a secret was no trouble. But Draco had just vanished after facing his father and showing him how far away from the wizarding superiority bullshit he was willing to go. But Draco, the pure-blooded son of a Death Eater, had broken his wand. They had taken the pieces of his wand. The children did. Lucius Malfoy just stepped over them as he ran after his son with his wand raised. The next weekend, Honeydukes had bags of broken chocolate wands, the ones they usually sold at a discount because they were broken beyond repair, shards of hard chocolate and biscuit for the most part, advertised in the storefront as dragon's pieces. People hadn't known if it was a tribute or tasteless. It didn't matter much because the shop suddenly closed for 3 days, and after it reopened, the wands were gone, and the owner had a haunted look and bruises he was ineffectually trying to cover. And the Prophet made no mention of Draco whatsoever, even when they were still reporting on the riots of Hogwarts. To this day, the twins were still in communication with Blaise Sabini because they wanted to do something, their own tribute, but had no idea what Draco liked or how he was. They had the fake wands that turned into a rubber chicken or a fish, and they could make them so that they broke and repaired themselves, but it felt hollow. Draco's act hadn't been a joke. Draco's act was the reason why a significant number of Slytherin students were not living in their families' homes at the moment. Not to worry. The Inter-House Solidarity Party worked holidays and summers. All students had been relocated, mostly to Miss Sabini's house, who thought it all hilarious. Her little boy, not 16 yet, and already bringing his own seraglio home. Remus had learned from a very young age to always count the time, and yet he had never been very good about it. Lily had told him once, when they were out of Hogwarts, that it happened to girls, too. Every month the same story, and still every month took you by surprise. Remus had refrained from pointing out the obvious difference between ruining a pair of cute panties and becoming a murderous monster because he didn't want to set up that joke. Someone would say it. He just knew someone would say girls became monsters, too. And Lily didn't throw curses around, but she would poison you and sit down to watch. Ask Walden. He counted the days now, and knew he had 3 weeks and 2 days to his next transformation. 22 days to find a place and make it secure, or 15 days to prepare the Wolfsbane. The Wolfsbane would make everything easier. They wouldn't have to find a secure and sturdy place nor leave the house. He could simply transform upstairs. He wouldn't even need Padfoot's company, although it would be welcome. The twins looked at the recipe, 3 pages long and full of steps. They had identical expressions of pain, one hand on their hair and the other on the table.
"We were never that good in potions to begin with. Scarving snack boxes are a success, but mostly because we always take careful notes of our failures. We were going for a potion that would change your hair color."
Scarving snack boxes were the candy that, if consumed, would make you sick enough to skip class. You would puke and develop nosebleeds and rashes, but your hair would certainly remain unchanged. Still, for some reason, they were willing to brew the potion themselves and risk the threat posed by an intelligent, feral werewolf in their apartment if it went wrong, rather than going for Remus's perfectly sensible suggestion of an alternative solution. Sirius took their side because Sirius had lost all sense of personal danger sometime in his 3rd year of Hogwarts. Since Remus was the only mature and reasonable person here, just like in school, really, he took the matter into his own hands. He nicked some of the official stationery and forged a letter in the twins' names. Mature and reasonable, yes. Stickler for the rules, no. Don't get those mixed up. It takes a lot of maturity to realize a rule is stupid and that you shouldn't feel bad for breaking it.
What?
That was the general thought in Severus's heavily occluded mind as the owl delivered the garishly purple envelope. Thank Merlin it was still the last few days of August and he was in Spinner's End. Alone, too, and hadn't he dodged a bullet when his darkness made some noises about Pettigrew going there to assist Severus? That had been before the debacle in the Ministry, and now Pettigrew had other matters to attend.
"Dear Professor Snape!"
Severus immediately dropped the letter and went to find some general antidote to wash his fingers. He read the rest without touching it, bending over in his living room and holding to his face a handkerchief soaked in antidote.
"We are writing to humbly request your advice on a potions problem we have encountered here at Weasley's Wizard Wheezes. We must admit that our knowledge of potions is deficient, despite having enjoyed your excellent lessons in Hogwarts. Although we have thoroughly explored the matter on our own, we have come to the conclusion that no one could direct and advise us better than yourself. Therefore, we respectfully beg for your assistance in this endeavor."
Once again, the only thought in Severus's mind was a very disturbed what.
"We are uncertain of our ability to accurately expose in writing the trouble we are finding, but nevertheless we will attempt to do so. The matter seems to be a deficiency in the quality of freshly brewed potions when apparating with them. Our venture is one that we believe requires extended discussion. As such, we would be most grateful if you could see to it to arrange for a meeting in person. Hoping to hear from you soon, we remain at your service. Mr. F. Weasley, Mr. G. Weasley."
Severus blinked quickly a few times. So not what, but who. Oh, clever, clever man. Sirius raised his head and stood immobile like a hunting dog staring at the door. The twins also looked up. Something wrong, something wicked, was in the shop. Fear. It was the sound of fear that had alerted them. Throats closing, unrequested excuses mumbled, feet shuffling to the door, hoping no one would notice. In a matter of seconds, the shop went from packed to just a few stragglers hiding in the Muggle magic section. George came out of the workshop to find Verity ducking under the till. She did whisper that the trouble was coming from the Wonder Witch section, but she didn't offer any help beyond that. Severus Snape was there, his black figure offering a stark contrast against all the vibrant pink of the packaging. He was staring impassively at the bubbling, melting mass of what had been a rather nice stand with love potions.
"Oi, that's our merchandise you're destroying,"
said George, who was a Gryffindor and also out of school. "You are out of school, out. He can't give you detention. Don't listen if he says he can, because he cannot." Snape's wand was still pointing at the remnants of the stand.
"So you admit being responsible for this?"
What few brave souls had remained in the shop after his entrance dropped their wares and left hurriedly as Snape began to recite his famous speech about consent and the responsibility of the potioner. This, while odd, was perfectly in character, as any Slytherin could tell you. Everyone was familiar with the speech, which he gave at the end of the year of studies, officially intended for the 1st years that were about to enter puberty, but everyone else was supposed to stay and listen as a refreshment. There was a pop quiz after, to ensure comprehension. When McNair was in his fifth year, Severus made him write 10 feet of scroll on the subject and then read it in the middle of the common room. No Slytherin would be surprised, precisely, that he chose to terrorize the Weasley shop. The speech ended. The potions had solidified into a glassy mass that would take forever to remove from the floor, even with Evanesco.
"Now show me the rest, Weasley." "But no student of mine will brew or provide this kind of potion. Show me the rest."
"Damn it, George, you coward!"
"Snivets, Snape,"
said Sirius, who was honestly trying to kick the habit of calling him Snivellus, but could make no promises if he was unprepared. Besides, the bastard had a very sibilant name. Snape had his wand arm extended, and his eyes were moving over the room and the supplies in a very precise and exact manner, like the hawk looking from the clouds for the snake it will soon devour.
"Ah, Severus! You're here! I thought I heard you make an entrance,"
Remus said as he slowly made his way down the stairs into the workroom.
"So good to see you! Will you please stop terrorizing the twins? They had very gallantly agreed to host us."
Severus was pointing at a package with his wand, and it was starting to smoke. He looked very pleased. At Remus's arrival, however, he agreed to drop the matter for the time being to talk business instead. Well, he and Remus talked business. The twins merely stood on the side, trying to deal with the shock, with varied success. They knew Severus was working for the Order, but this, they hadn't expected this surprise. What did this mean? The end result was that they would stay there, and Remus would have his wolfsbane. Even if Severus couldn't risk coming to the shop every month, they quickly devised a system so he could drop it somewhere and one of the twins could get it. And yes, goblin-made glass, essential to maintain a potion's properties when apparating. There was, however, a feeling of something unfinished. Sirius got the impression that there was something that was not done or said, something big and unacknowledged sitting between Remus and Snape. There are things you do at age 20 you don't do at 36. Go out without a jacket, drink all night, risk your cover and your life to get 5 quality minutes with your boyfriend. So, of course, neither of them stepped outside to the alley. Of course, they focused on the task at hand and that the war was coming, that was already here at the door. Of course, they didn't risk everything for 5 minutes of snogging, but that didn't mean they didn't want to. The tragedy, however, wasn't that they didn't get 5 minutes to themselves. The tragedy was that they didn't even have the opportunity to talk, to know if the other... It had all been blurry and undefined before. Were they perhaps presuming too much about what they had? Had the arrest in Azkaban and time dispelled it? Like opening a window in a room full of smoke? It hadn't, of course it hadn't, but they didn't know. Remus suspected, because Severus was hopelessly romantic and caring and stupidly self-sacrificing, and he had dropped everything to come give him a potion, but still, a few minutes of clear, open conversation would be welcome, because neither of them knew if the other blamed them for what had happened. Voldemort wanted 2 things. Harry Potter's death, and Severus couldn't help but wonder at the phrasing. He wanted his death, not to kill him himself, and Albus Dumbledore's death. Severus was in the perfect position to bring the second one. To his surprise, Dumbledore called him for a private meeting, just the two of them and no other Order member, and revealed he wanted the exact same thing. The bloody same 2 things. Albus Percival Wulfric's sodding bastard Dumbledore wanted Harry's death and his own.
"Have you, perchance, been confounded?" Severus asked. Quite reasonably, he thought.
Dumbledore was quite sure he was not. Dumbledore was very clever. Dumbledore had a brilliant plan that he now chose to share with Severus, and he swore would never know how close he came to being murdered right there and then. Severus had had that spot to hide a body since Quirrell. It was a pity that it was still unused. Because here was the thing. Harry was so obviously an accidental Horcrux, and yes, it was very sad, but he would have to die for Voldemort to be defeated. Preferably willingly. Not to worry. He had made sure to win the boy's love and trust. He would do it. Harry would sacrifice himself for the wizarding world. Severus stared. His mind was overtaken by images of a burned and blackened land in which Harry didn't live, and then by the 9 years of sunshine they had had at the cottage.
They had had a good decade, sans Voldemort. Could they not return him to that state of half-life? Could they not make that the penalty for his crimes while Harry went on to live happily? He could not utter a single word for fear of what he would say. All Severus could think was that Remus would tear Dumbledore's and anyone's throat apart, and he wouldn't even have to be transformed. Then came the next big reveal. Dumbledore wouldn't be around to tell Harry that he had to die. No, that task would be deferred to others. He was preparing his friends to learn about Horcruxes, so they could relay the information. Harry, of course, wouldn't question his friends, and at the right time, and not a minute earlier, Harry would know his duty, and he would perform his sacrifice. But Dumbledore wouldn't get to see it. "I am growing old, my friend," he said. "I paid a high price on that duel, one from which I won't recover. My end approaches, and I have accepted it. Only one thing remains, the power to bring my end in a certain way." Dumbledore understood that if he were to die alone or in another duel, the hit to the morale of the wizarding world would be immense. If he were to fight Voldemort again and be defeated, as he was sure would happen, people would lose all hope. They couldn't have that. "You might have been sorted in Slytherin after all," Severus said at last, because he had to say something before his silence became too much. This was the brilliantly devious idea. Have Severus kill him in a suitably dramatic and painless fashion. Dumbledore would be spared his agony, and Severus would have the ultimate proof of loyalty to Voldemort, the perfect position from which to help the cause. All Severus heard was, "I will get a hero's death, and you will be reviled. And in the end it won't matter, because Harry will be dead. I have poisoned his mind enough that he would believe that he has to give up his life. Harry." Wonderful Harry, with his funny thinking, and his Slytherin ways, and Lily's gift for potions, and most importantly, Lily's laugh and Lily's light. Harry, who had inadvertently saved Severus's soul and heart, and was now saving him, once again, from losing his mind and becoming a murderer ahead of time. Funny thing, Severus was a dreadful Death Eater. He had never killed or tortured anyone. He allowed others to do it, which in his opinion was quite as bad. He didn't speak up against the atrocities of his friends, but he had never killed. Nor would he now, as much as he wanted to. The worst threat a Slytherin can make is that they have taken an oath not to kill you. To Voldemort, he said, if and when Harry reappeared, Dumbledore and the Order would be the first to know. It was vital that Severus kept his position there. It was vital that they maintained their formation. Dumbledore's death would mean their disbanding, and then no one would be there to receive the news about Harry. And Voldemort was pleased by Severus's thoughts. He could wait, then, and he could try again to secure the prophecy. He could not say how important it was to hear in full. No, he could not. Severus was surprised to notice something in his darkness's voice, a careful tightening of the modulation, something not unlike Severus's own, something he knew to be the careful hiding of a secret. Voldemort was hiding something, something that had to do with the night of his return, that no one remembered. To Dumbledore, he said, Harry wasn't here. He wasn't here to be guided and manipulated. There was no guarantee that the message would get to him. Better wait, then. As much as possible. What if Dumbledore's death sent him into deeper hiding? Please send him into deeper hiding. Please let him disappear forever, even if Severus never got to see him again. As long as he were out and away from this madness, Severus would be close to happy. Dumbledore was less satisfied, but he acquiesced. Severus was nothing if not persuasive. Still, Dumbledore put the word through the Order to find Sirius and Remus. Sirius was innocent, and he needed their help. And Remus, too. Poor Remus, so lost, so confused. If they found them, they could find Harry. In Severus's rooms at Hogwarts, there was a basket of apples brought from Turkey, from a very old orchard in the middle of the country. There are no words to express the dismay of the students when they discovered who was going to be the DADA teacher that year. "At least we'll learn something," offered Dean Thomas, ever the optimist. "After 5 years of learning nothing," pointed out Ron Weasley, not inaccurately, "he's going to kill us and eat us whole." He was not wrong.
Snape was very aware of the lacking education they had received, and even more conscious of the threat approaching. Summer seemed to have cleaned everything and pushed things back to their usual place, as if nothing important had happened. New paint to cover the cracks. Dumbledore was back, and so was the point system. The changes they had asked for had been implemented in the less expected way. They had now an adequately knowledgeable DADA teacher, and yet he was the last person anyone wanted or expected. Even the Slytherins were disgruntled. He was their head of house. They had learned to fear him. The curriculum for Muggle studies had also been hurriedly updated. No one seemed satisfied by it, but they accepted that it was a step forward, even if a small and clumsy one. It was less patronizing, at the very least. Professor Binns, unfortunately, was still teaching history as he had been doing for decades. The Board of Governors was satisfied, and parents everywhere breathed a bit more easily, knowing that all that ministry nonsense had been put to rest. Hopefully the children would now get some proper schooling and everything would be fine. It would be. Scrimgeour was in power, and so was Dumbledore. All was well. But Hogwarts had changed at its core, and all this was nothing more than trappings to dress the truth. The cracks were there, and they were deeper than anyone had realized. The point system was back, and the first years still cared a bit about it, but no one else worried, and if they did, because some people are perfectionist goody-goodies with anxiety, they were sent to have a chat with Zabini, and they stopped worrying. There was also an open house policy. Well, not policy, because they kept the passwords, and the Board of Governors kept saying things like how important it was to respect tradition, so yes, not policy precisely, but most times the professors merely looked very tired when they found out-of-house students in their common room, and they did not fight it, so everybody was free to visit any of the four houses. Official regulations be damned. Hufflepuff had, by far, the coziest common room. Who would have known? No one. No one before would have guessed it. No wonder they were so polite and laid back. You would be too if you had such a nice warm room with the perfect lighting to read, but without the glare hurting your eyes. They had cushions. They had pumpkin-shaped soft armchairs where you could nap. They had proper insulated windows, unlike the tower houses. Perhaps things could be pushed back into a semblance of normalcy, but once tasted, there was no way the students were giving up on that wonderful room. No way were they going back to separate houses. Once someone asks, "Where are the women?" there is no way you will look the same way at a history book. Gryffindor was a bit surprised and a bit upset to discover no one cared about their common room, which was high and windy. So was Ravenclaw's. But at least once you arrived there, you could get someone to help you with homework. Everybody agreed that Slytherin's was a bit gloomy and a bit melancholic, and yet it attracted Ravenclaw's like the candle to a bunch of bespectacled flies. You could see under the lake in that room. They had a big underwater window, and the Ravenclaws found it very relaxing. Snape got used to the vision of Ravenclaw girls hugging the glass of the window lake and crying with joy when the merpeople came to say hello. Adventure books and movies very rarely feature bathrooms, unless there is a fight in them. It is quite understandable. A hero deserves a certain degree of privacy, and nothing takes the drama away as a hint of toilet humor. Draco didn't find any humor in the situation. He would like to take a shower, to wash the sweat away, and the acromantula's little hairs. He found that he couldn't, because all of the bathrooms of the house had one problem or another. The one on the first floor had something hairy growing on the floor, and the mirror was cursed, and the toilet paper dispenser tried to bite Harry on the hand. But mostly it was the hair. They didn't want to set foot on it. The master bathroom on the second floor had a freaking vampire inside that almost killed Draco from a heart attack before either of them had the chance of doing anything else. He was also quite rude, as he insisted on attempting to eat both Draco and Harry instead of taking the exit they were offering him. Nothing like the previous vampires Draco had encountered. Neither of them could remember when they were supposed to have studied vampires, but they were quite sure that they hadn't. Still, they dealt with it successfully. Quidditch seeker reflexes for the win. But the bathroom had to be indefinitely closed after that. They hung a warning sign on the door and everything. They were not certain whether they had actually killed him or not. How could you tell with a vampire? This was a particularly old and wrinkly one. Would that make a difference? And they didn't dare open the door to check. The bathroom on the third floor, the one that Sirius and Regulus would have shared a lifetime ago, had spiders and crawling jitterings, and what was worse, the water had no pressure and might not even be water. It was unclear whether it was rust or blood, but it certainly didn't serve the purpose of showering. There was no bathroom on the ground floor because, at the time the house was built, bathrooms were considered shameful, and you would not have one on the same floor where you received visitors. They may do with the third floor, possibly blood coming from the pipes bathroom. Most mysteriously, the problem was in the shower. They could wash their hands all right in the sink. It was a funny thing that the four of them were condemned to perpetual underestimation. It suited their interests, but still. Remus had it worse, because in Remus's case, it was doable. They heard werewolf and immediately pictured a savage beast incapable of human intelligence and sensitivity, and people kept thinking that way even after meeting him. Like at any point, Remus could snap and attempt to eat your left arm raw. Then they saw Remus, the soft, polite, conscious Remus, and they thought he was meek. Thought he was like a dog in need of a master. Either a monster or a beast to be broken and tamed. People forgot how strong he was, is the point, and how clever. Remus had a scarily good memory and stored knowledge like other people collected bad decisions. Sirius, too, was often underestimated. It was stranger in his case because he was handsome and flashing. His talent should be obvious. And yet people tended to think it was mostly a facade of absurdly high self-confidence brought on by his wealth and pureblood status. Plus, he had studied at the same time that James No Middle Name Potter, the boy who was good at Quidditch and Transfiguration and McGonagall's favorite student despite herself. So perhaps one could be excused for not seeing the beauty of Sirius's charms, the potency in each and every one of them. The way in which he took the rules of magic and bent them to his will, and how he was so justified in his self-confidence. Sirius used his wand like the surgeon with the scalpel and the artist with the brush, precisely and effectively. He also did it mostly for chaos, but do not be mistaken, it was a beautiful, professionally crafted chaos. And the twins. Pranksters. Jokesters. The only Weasleys not to become prefects, and the ones who took the fewest owls and didn't care about the newts, always with their silly jokes, always laughing. They seemed so irresponsible, so immature, so careless. Together they had developed over 30 new products, which required the invention or radically new application of over 20 spells. To contextualize, spells were invented one at a time by a single wizard. If the wizard was very prolific, he might get 3 spells in his lifetime, but rarely more than that. But those two wonderful idiots didn't care. They played and experimented and came up with new things, and they were bringing magic to the 20th century, regardless of what anyone said. And yet they were all underestimated, because what they did and what they were wasn't considered important. The eccentric pureblood and the werewolf and the twins that preferred laughter over serious studies. They could not do anything truly valuable. Well, they had just developed a cloak with an imbued Protego charm that would save over 2 dozen lives in the approaching war. You know, for fun. Plus Protego hats. And gloves that protected from poisons and cursed objects. Oh, and the calling wands, still in development. A small hand-sized wooden wand that easily fit in all kinds of pockets. Break it, and it will emit an alarm signal and call up the 3 wizards or witches you had previously designated to come to your help. Now that was a tribute for the founder of the Interhouse Solidarity Party, the boy who broke his wand. But this week they were launching the cloak. Available in a variety of colors, black, sky blue, and bubblegum pink, and patterns. Dancing house elves or brooms. It was guaranteed to stop up to 12 curses for the modest price of 30 sickles. It wouldn't work forever, and it didn't stop everything. It certainly couldn't stop a killing curse. But it stopped surprise attacks, that was for sure. And it gave you a fighting chance. It made all the difference. Shacklebolt had already acquired one. So had Moody. Sirius thought they were kind of ugly, and the black ones, because black never fails you in couture. I should make that my personal motto, by the way. We're badly cut, and rather than looking dramatic and badass, you looked like a scared crow. Not a scarecrow, but a frightened bird, tangled up in a trash bag. Yes, well, the fabric was at a discount, said Fred, who, unlike George, had a very keen sense for finances. The development of protective hats took more time because they ran into some trouble with the prototypes. Meaning that during the testing phase, they almost severed George's ear because they still hadn't gotten the range right. As if by a secret pact, both Dumbledore and Voldemort avoided a new confrontation between the two of them. Instead, the next week saw them working on building strength and resources. Dumbledore tracked down Marvolo's ring. He did not put it on, thank Merlin, but he was injured all the same by the wards protecting the place. Voldemort sealed an alliance with the giants. The werewolves came to his call. Dumbledore thought he had learned the location of Slytherin's locket, but he had grown more cautious after the ring and did not try to retrieve it by himself. Neither did he take brilliant, brave Hermione Granger to retrieve it with him, perhaps because he rightly guessed that McGonagall would have his head. But the girl still learned about Horcruxes, knowing she would have to inform Harry at some point. Because Voldemort would never stop hunting her dear friend, and Harry needed help if he was to defeat Voldemort. Slowly, Voldemort augmented his power in the Ministry. More and more wizards and witches were coming to his call. And that was the scariest part of all, that people would follow his madness. Dumbledore did all he could to protect the school and the children in it. And neither managed to find the elusive Harry Potter. All they knew was that he was alive. Severus was risking his life doing this. No, not only his life, because he would be the first to admit that the life of a bitter ex-Death Eater wasn't worth much. Others disagreed on that point, but also the lives of many others who depended on him. He was risking his life coming again to Weasley's Wizard Weezes, so soon after his last visit. Not even 6 months passed, which would be the bare minimum. Also, he could deliver some news and some ingredients in person, and get maybe 3 minutes of solitude with his lover. Ex-lover, he didn't know, hence the need for that time. Only 3 minutes, because, truly, he could not afford more time. He was still a triple spy with a day job that was extra hard. He should have known. Severus never got nice things. Not when it was a matter of heart. He had arranged it so carefully, too. Everybody would have something to hold in their hands and go store it safely, and he would have his 3 minutes, maybe four, with Remus. Were it not for that blight on the face of the earth that was Sirius Black. "Excellent," he said, the dunderhead. "Mooney, will you hold this? Thanks. I have something to discuss with Snipe." And he took Severus by the arm and pushed him to the workshop behind the storeroom. Sirius should have died from the tension between Remus and Severus. He should have dropped dead from the intensity on Severus's gaze, but no, he didn't, the bastard. Remus had looked equally frustrated and amused. He had not looked relieved at not finding himself alone with Severus. That was probably a good thing. All the more frustrating, though. "Snipe!" Sirius said the word as if he were casting a spell. He took a big dramatic breath. "I am sorry." There were so many quips on Severus's tongue. "And yet here you are. I am sorry, too, by your presence. Just what in the seven hells do you think you are doing, ruining my carefully arranged private time? Not sorry enough? Let me show you the true meaning of the word." But he didn't say any of them. This idiot was Remus's. Remus's friend, perhaps Remus's ex-lover. He had eyes. Sirius was as gorgeous now as he had been then. Maybe even Remus's current lover. And that thought hurt the most, but it was a familiar hurt. He was never anyone's first choice. And perhaps he would be replaced, not only in Remus's affections, but also in Harry's life. And that was a dreadful thought that felt like stone crumbling and suffocating him. But it didn't matter. It didn't change anything other than Severus's pulse. He would still fight Voldemort. He would still help Dumbledore, up to a point. And he would still, above anything else, make sure that Harry survived the war and had a happy home at the end. And that was the initial goal, and it would be the last. Whether Severus was happy, or even whether he survived, didn't matter. This was not about him. Sirius kept talking. "I was horrible to you in school, and I should never have played that prank on you. None of the pranks, actually, but you know which one I mean." How do you even respond to that? "I know nothing I do or say will make a difference, but nevertheless, I apologize," Sirius went on. He nodded at Severus with a martial air. "You might punch me in the face now, if you would like." "What?" Severus really only had 3 minutes to spare. He left without having spoken to Remus or punched Sirius and feeling slightly dizzy from the shock. Sirius was right. Apologizing didn't change the years of bullying, the loneliness and despair he had felt, the abandon with which he had thrown himself into the arms of the first person to show some genuine interest in him, another lie, and the mistakes he had made because of that. But since Severus hadn't been a pushover exactly, and did manage to cast some curses of his own, he could look back and see that he hadn't been a victim as much as an enemy in a stupid and pointless school war. The kids were right. The house system was perverse. Sirius's apology didn't change the past, but it could change the present and the future. Severus didn't punch him, and instead shook his hand. End of chapter 3. For the full text of this and other stories by the same author, visit the AO3 page as well as the Tumblr of author Andrina. First pass editing by Ohana. Music by Sean Johnson. If you would like to commission me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch using the contact information on my website, which is located at samgabrielvo.com. And there you can find the stories that I've read, as well as links to my Patreon page, to which I hope you will consider subscribing to support me, and my Discord server, where I record things live for your enjoyment. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.